Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Water is what we talk about this hour with Charles Fishman, who's going to be in Milwaukee to discuss the economics of water with area business and community leaders on January 19. He's the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, How Water Resources Will Come to Define This Century. He spent 3 years studying the resources of water throughout the world, and he writes about countries that have water shortages, about people who have to walk for miles to be able to get their daily supply of water. He looks at the bottled water industry, about pure water, about the number of people who don't have access to water. In the course of writing the book, he stood at the bottom of a 500,000-gallon sewage tank, sampled water directly from the springs in San Pellegrino, Italy, and Poland Spring, Maine, and carried water on his head for 3 kilometers with a group of Indian villagers. His previous book is The Walmart Effect, The Standard for Understanding Walmart's Impact on Our Economy and How We Live. He's former Metro and national reporter for The Washington Post, was a reporter and editor at the Orlando Sentinel and the News and Observer in Raleigh. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Charles, and we've talked about this issue before. We'll get a lot of calls, I know, particularly when we hit the issue of bottled water. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. What a great introduction. It sounds like I had fun.
Did you have fun, Charles?
I did have fun. I must say that learning about water was a really remarkable adventure. And, you know, if you have to carry water on your head, I'd never read an account of any Western reporter carrying water on his or her head. We've all seen these pictures of developing world women and girls with the water jugs on their head. And I went looking to see what that was like. And I couldn't find a single account of it. And so when I was in India, I really made sure that the folks who were helping guide me around took me to a village where I could do that. And that was just, I walked for an hour, and I carried barely enough water on my head to flush a toilet once.
Oh,
that water weighed 20 pounds.
Whew.
I was carrying one-third less water than the 9-year-old girl I was walking with. She was carrying 30 pounds.
Oh.
So incredible, and I spilled half the water. It's not a great way to move water.
And maybe we should all do something like that so we pay attention to water.
Well, it's actually really simple. What's remarkable is that probably the number 2 or number 3 grocery item in the United States is the 24-pack of half-liter bottles of water.
Yeah.
And that weighs about 24 pounds. So if you put it on your head as you emerge from the grocery store, imagine most Americans, I bring it when I talk about water. I have one so people can test it out. Most Americans wouldn't make it from the door of the grocery store to the car.
Mm-hmm.
And a 9-year-old girl I walked with does that morning and night with more weight than that and doesn't spill a drop, because anything she spills, she doesn't have to use later. So
how many,
absolutely, it's remarkable.
How many people in the world have to do that, and how many people in the world don't have access to water to drink that's clean?
Well, the figures from the UN and the World Health Organization are that 40% of the people in the world, that's 4 out of 10, either don't have access to clean, safe drinking water or have to work to get it. I'm sorry, have to walk to get it. And so, and it's about half and half. 40% of the people in the world is 2.5 billion people. About 1 billion don't have clean, safe water. That is, they have access to water, but it's tainted in some way. And about 1.5 billion rely on water that someone has walked to get. So you're talking about 300 million people walking to get water every day. who then supply, you know, each of whom supplies a family of four or five. 300 million people is everybody in the United States.
Right.
So it's astonishing, and to be honest, we should be mortified that anybody in the world has to walk to get water. It's almost never, if you can walk 3 kilometers to get water, how come there isn't a pipe?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's, if you can walk out to get the water, then obviously the water's available, and it could be brought to where you're living. And so when I say we should be mortified, we should be embarrassed, as human beings, obviously, in most cases, that is the failure of the communities, the regions, the countries in which those people live. But water service is such a basic element. The remarkable thing is I did this walk in this Indian village, Jargali, to get water. We walked out from the village to the well and then back. And there were 13 women and girls with me, and I think there were 3 adult women and 10 girls and me. And the adult women and I never lost cell phone service. So we were walking out to get water and walking back, carrying the water, and the whole time we had cell phone service. And to me,
what a jarring.
Well, it's just absurd. That means
right.
It's obviously possible to provide infrastructure, and the question is, you know, where does the money come from, and where does the demand come from? I mean, one of the questions I tried to understand is why communities that don't have water aren't, you know, banging their pots and demanding water from their local government officials, and that's a really complicated issue, but it's really an embarrassment to humanity, and the costs of bad water are just extraordinary, you know, all around the world in health terms and economics.
Yes. And Charles, how do you reconcile what you just talked about with the fact that we spent $16 billion, we will this year, on bottled water in this country?
The number's even bigger. I don't know where you got your $16 billion. The number at retail is $21 billion. And I'll tell you what, the comparison that's really astonishing is Americans spend $21 billion on bottled water, and we spend $46 billion maintaining the entire infrastructure of the water system in the country. We spend almost as much on water delivered in crushable plastic bottles as we do maintain all the pipes, pumps, treatment plants. All of that only comes to $46 billion, and we're spending $21 billion on bottled water. So I think bottled water is a little bit of a distraction. What I say to people is, when your water bill goes up, don't complain about the water bill. We're already spending money on water. We're buying it one bottle at a time. There's plenty of money to fix the water system. It's just going, at the moment, it's going to the wrong place. And so, you know, I'm not here to tell anybody whether they should or should not drink bottled water, but bottled water is not the solution to water problems here or anywhere else, in fact. And in the U.S., to me, it's just an indicator that if water's presented the right way, we're perfectly happy to pay. We pay the typical bottle of water costs more than the same amount of gasoline. And if you think about the work necessary to make the gasoline and the work necessary to make the water, that's truly absurd.
Mm-hmm.
So we shouldn't be whining when the water bill goes from $31 a month to $35 a month, because that's a huge system that the entire economy relies on. And bottled water is just an indulgence. You know, it's something that makes us feel good, but it's completely unnecessary. There's no moment when we need bottled water. And by the same token, I've now spent a lot of time in places that don't have good water service.
Right.
And there's no moment when the economy of Milwaukee or Wisconsin or Madison or this whole country doesn't rely on clean, dependable water all the time.
Well, it must be a jarring experience to be a person who's poor living in Fiji, not having access to clean water, when you've got this huge bottled water plant down the road from you that's shipping this exclusive, exquisite water to people in Beverly Hills.
It is. I think in some ways it's more jarring for us, the customers of Fiji Water, if you come to understand that, than it is for the people in Fiji. People in places that don't have water have had to figure out how to accommodate themselves to that. And so the amazing thing, I got to take this journey to Fiji to see where Fiji Water came from. And I got to go all the way to the factory, interview people who worked at the factory. I visited the villages around the factory. Fiji Water is a very smartly run company. I think there's no question about that just from the way it's presented in this country and the rest of the world. And they have made sure that the villages from which their employees come all now have a good, reliable water supply. And I think the numbers about Fiji Water are so crazy that it's hard to get your brain around. Fiji is a very small country, only 700,000 people in the whole country. So the country is much smaller than Wisconsin. And 300,000 of those people work harvesting sugar. So whatever, almost half the population. 300 people work at the Fiji Water Factory. The 300 people at the Fiji Water Factory generate more revenue for the country, for the gross domestic product of the country, than the 300,000 people harvesting sugar. The water exported to Beverly Hills is far more valuable than the sugar exported to New Zealand and Australia. So one way they think about it is, hey, these crazy Westerners want to pay us a lot of money for water. Great. It works for us.
Tell me, read stories recently about, particularly a couple of years ago, the cities of Atlanta, Barcelona, Spain, some cities in the western part of the United States facing water shortages, Atlanta almost running out of water. Is this likely to continue, and why did this happen, Charles?
Well, Atlanta is a really good and kind of important example. Atlanta gets all its almost all its water from a reservoir called Lake Lanier. And during the drought that went from 2006 to 2008, Lake Lanier dropped to its low. It's a huge reservoir. It dropped to the lowest level it had been since it was filled. So it had never been this low except when it was coming up, having had the dam built. And the communities in the Atlanta metro area simply don't have a great approach to water management. And they don't control Lake Lanier. Lake Lanier is owned and operated as a reservoir and a dam by the federal government. There are all kinds of rules about how much water the communities can take. And the people of Atlanta, the leaders of Atlanta, have consistently imagined two things. One, that it would simply rain and they'd be okay. And two, they are engaged in what is now an almost 30-year lawsuit to allow them to get more water out of Lake Lanier. They're just pursuing this in the courts. Lake Lanier supplies not just Atlanta, but literally the states of Florida and Alabama as well. And Atlanta does not have thoughtful, forward-looking water management. There's more than enough water in the metro region of Atlanta in northwest Georgia for Atlanta. But all Atlanta's ever done is take water from Lake Lanier. And they never sit back and take a sort of long-term approach. There's 53 water utilities in the metro region. And so they have the worst of all possible worlds. Every one of those water utilities is relatively small. They all just sort of take what they want. There's no coordination. It's a perfect example of how control that is too local can actually damage your own community and all the communities around it. And so it's a complicated situation, but I would say it's a perfect example of there's more than enough water. Atlanta shouldn't have had a crisis. The thing that's lacking is leadership and thinking about the future. And so, in fact, in the book, in The Big Thirst, this doesn't sound like it's any fun to read, and I think it's more fun to read than this one sentence expression of it. But that's the central message, which is most of the time water problems aren't about water. They're about people not taking a step back, looking at what's available, looking at what they need, and connecting the dots in the right way. And it, you know, of all places in the country, Atlanta certainly has the resources to fix its water problems. It just engages in wishful thinking instead.
Charles Fishman is our guest this hour. He's going to be in Milwaukee on January 19. Tempo is hosting him to talk about the economics of water with business and community leaders in this area. He's the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time, we'll be looking at Ulysses Grant. And at 9 o'clock tomorrow, big political week in Wisconsin. The recall signatures will be delivered. Mike Tate, chair of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, will be joining us tomorrow to talk about that. And then we hope to have a Republican representative from the Republican Party of Wisconsin, not yet booked, but we hope that will happen Thursday at 9. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Charles Fishman, and our first caller is Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. You take the eastern part of Wisconsin, Waukesha, they are running out of water, and I'm just interested in water tables. They are running out of water. Now, here in the western part of the state, our water tables are good, and we got all kinds of artesian wells in this western part of the state. And the water tables can vary. They wanted to or are going to, and they may have already, dug a high-capacity well down at Gay's Mill, up on the ridge down there. And I'm just wondering how hard those high-capacity wells are on the water table. Thanks much.
Thank you, Eugene.
Well, Eugene asked a very specific question, which is if you've got a community built over an aquifer, built over water underground, and you build, you know, large wells with high-powered pumps, what impact does that have on the aquifer? And the answer to that is it depends on the aquifer. It depends on how much water is down there. What impact does the water that Milwaukee takes out of Lake Michigan have on Lake Michigan? Essentially none. Lake Michigan's huge. The amount of water that a single city uses out of a body of water that large is relatively small. Aquifers are much different. Aquifers need to be recharged. And so one of the questions to ask before you build a well like that is, where is the water in the aquifer come from in the first place? And if we take out, you know, 10 million gallons a day or 100 million gallons a day, how is the aquifer going to be replenished? And there are all kinds of ways of doing that. Some aquifers replenish very quickly from rainfall. In fact, the water that you drink in the Fiji water bottle comes from an aquifer in Fiji that is continuously replenished. The Fiji water plant has big wells, but it doesn't damage that aquifer at all. In contrast, the aquifer under the entire plains of the United States, the Oglala, is huge. It's as big as six states. And yet it replenishes slowly. The rainfall is episodic. And farmers and cities take so much water from the Oglala that an underground lake the size of six states is seeing its water level fall, you know, a foot or more every year. That's very dangerous. So the key to me is to ask the question, what can the aquifer bear? And then there's a second point, and we often don't think about this, but if you're taking water from the aquifer and using it in your community, at some point you're done with the water. Instead of cleaning it and sending it into a river, clean it and send it right back down into the aquifer so you sustain the resource that you're relying on. We haven't thought about water that way, but it's not that hard to close the loop and help the water system help us. So it's a question of asking the right questions up front.
Thank you, Eugene. Cody in Oshkosh. Hi, Cody.
Hi. My question is, we spend trillions of dollars on military. I was wondering what your opinion is of if we supplied clean water to people and possibly other small infrastructure projects that aren't that expensive, how would that affect national security?
Well, Cody, you've stolen one of my good lines that I use sometimes. You have to be careful what audience you use it with. In the last 11 years, we have spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's what the military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq have cost, an incredible sum of money. We could have supplied water to every single person on Earth, to the 2.5 billion people on Earth who don't have water, with that $1 trillion. That $1 trillion would easily have paid to create pipelines and wells and install pumps for every village and town that doesn't have water. And if we had done that, would we be better off in global political terms than the way we spent the $1 trillion? I would argue that we would have certainly been much better off. The problem is that's a false choice. It looks like a real choice, but it isn't. The security issues in Iraq and Afghanistan have real urgency. The fact that half the people who live in India, 600 million people, twice the population of the United States, the fact that those 600 million people don't have water doesn't seem like an urgent problem. And so we never were going to spend $1 trillion providing everybody on Earth with water. There's no congressional leader, there's no political candidate who's going to argue for spending our grandchildren's money on supplying water to other people. But I think the point that you raise in the background is really important, and that is water is actually a relatively inexpensive thing to provide to people, and all the technology exists. We don't need any new breakthroughs about how to provide a village with water, and you create enormous goodwill and enormous economic energy. If people don't have to walk to get water, if people don't have to worry about their kids being sick, you know, 3 months a year because of bad water, that unleashes all kinds of economic energy and educational opportunity. And so when we think about how to spend money overseas, I think providing water is a great way to do it. And so, you know, it's an important lever to push. There are certainly people in the State Department and in the nonprofit world who understand that. It's just a hard argument to make to ordinary Americans often.
Well, when you were walking with those women in India, I'm sure that the subject of a pipe that would carry the water that would keep them from having to walk that far to get water must have come up. Why is it that can't you go to a local member of council or go to the government and say, hey, could we have a pipe?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Kathleen. It's all about whatever community you're in, and it completely depends. In the villages of India, a typical village has between 1,000 and 2,000 people, and it has and half the people in India live in villages like that. So there are 600,000 villages of 1,000 or 2,000 people, and the elders in that village they are the quote unquote elders, the quote unquote council. But they don't have any taxing power. They don't have any financial resources available to them. And the village may or may not even have electricity. And so, in fact, nonprofit groups that want to provide relatively high-tech water purification equipment to these villages often find, even if somebody comes along and says, we'll give you this little plant, it's no bigger than a big screen TV, it works great, it needs a little electricity and it needs somebody to watch over it, and it will make water for your village. It'll change your lives. The problem is there's nobody to provide and pay for the electricity. There's nobody to watch over the piece of technology. If it breaks, people just shrug and say, well, it worked for a while and now it doesn't. And so each region of the world that doesn't have water has a whole set of political and social problems, and you have to make sure you give people the technology and the solution that they can handle.
Mm-hmm.
So the person I went around with in India is an Indian who used to work for Unilever and has returned home to help his community, this, which includes the village I did the walk in, get water resources. And he's creating businesses and incentives and, you know, here's the well, here's the pipe. I'm going to give you the money to start a business selling irrigation water to the farmers along the route of the pipe. That way you've got revenue to maintain the pump and the electricity. He understands what's missing because he's Indian and he's also lived in the Western world. And so it seems like the solutions are simple and the technology, the engineering is never hard, but often the social and political elements really require someone from right there to say, okay, that piece of equipment's cool, but no one here is going to ever understand how to operate that. So we need a different solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
Thanks, Cody. Laura in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks to you and Rhonda and Chrissy for always bringing matters of great import. And thanks to Charles Fishman for his research and for appearing on the show. On January 5th, I believe, on this very station, on the On Point program, which is broadcast out of WBUR, there was a discussion of a book, I believe the title was A Great Aridness, where the speakers posited the dire prospect that Lake Mead could literally fail, they thought, by 2026 because the water level falls, and they thought it was possible that it would fall below the level of the intake pipes. And they say that Colorado River water literally supplies about 30 million people, and even raised the specter of a mass migration back northward. Wonder if your research addressed the Colorado River and Lake Mead.
All those Las Vegas casino dealers and hotel clerks moving back to Wisconsin. Winter isn't so bad after all. Well, the folks who the scientists who are studying Lake Mead and have written A Great Aridness are much more schooled in the meteorology and the hydrology. Is it going to rain? Will enough rain fall in exactly the right place to run into the Colorado River and then into Lake Powell and into Lake Mead? They're two big reservoirs on the Colorado River. And as Laura said, the Colorado River itself, which starts in the mountains near Denver, supplies 30 million people in western states. Among other folks, Las Vegas drinks out of Lake Mead, but so does Los Angeles. The Imperial Valley of California, where most of the winter vegetables for the country, most of the vegetables that we in the U.S. Eat at this time of year, lettuce, broccoli, tomatoes, comes from the Imperial Valley. The Imperial Valley is a desert. It's irrigated with Lake Mead water. So if Lake Mead falls to the point where it's unusable, that is going to be a colossal disaster. And it's not the kind of colossal disaster that you can fix, for instance, with bottled water by sending more trucks to Las Vegas and Los Angeles, because the volumes of water are just enormous. Cities use huge quantities of water for all kinds of things. Only 5% of the water cities provide, for instance, ends up being drunk by anybody. 95% is used for other things. And so I don't know whether the prediction that the lake will be dry in 2025 or 2026 is true. Even the guys who are predicting that it might don't know whether it'll be true or not. I think their point was to say, wow, lots of communities that are very large rely on this one source of water. And if you look at the historic weather trends, that might be a big mistake. We might go 10 years or 15 years with not enough rain to sustain the people who live off that water. What will they do then? What is your plan B? And I think that is really their main point. Their main point is, if you've got a city of 2 million people, or in the case of Las Vegas, in the case of Los Angeles, a city of 4 million people, that relies on a source of water that might not be there for some reason in 10 years, you need to have a plan B. Las Vegas does not, at the moment, have a plan B. Los Angeles, of course, sits on the Pacific Ocean, so in a crisis, Los Angeles could build desalination plants and get clean water from the ocean, although that would be expensive, and they'd need to move really fast. And so I think that that's exactly the point that I've tried to make in other settings, which is you need to ask the question, how reliable is our source of water? And if climate change or population growth or the economy changes in some way that changes our availability, that changes how much water we've got access to from that source, what's our backup plan?
Right.
And so I think that's their point, rather than to scare people into moving out of Las Vegas.
Except maybe somebody should have thought, why are we living here in the first place? But that's water under the bridge, right?
Well, it's a great question. And in fact, the people in Las Vegas who set the zoning rules say that woman over there, Patricia Mulroy, is in charge of getting us water. And the woman in charge of making sure Las Vegas has enough water says, it's not my job to decide how big the town is. They tell me how many people there are going to be, and I find the water.
Right.
So it actually, Kathleen, is a great question, which is, do you ever connect the amount of water available to how to the economic growth of the community? Right now, we don't,
mm-hmm.
but we should.
Yeah.
And you know, you could have a $15,000 water connection fee for every house in Las Vegas. And guess what? All of a sudden, building a house in Las Vegas wouldn't seem that appealing.
Right.
And the $15,000 would be, hey, if you guys are going to use 150,000 gallons worth of water a year, we got to go find it. That's what the $15,000 is for. So you could link those things. We don't now, and we need to.
Mm-hmm. Laura, thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Tell me about, you have written that, and I thought about that this morning when I had a glass of water. The water coming out of your kitchen tap can be as old as 4 billion years and might well have been sipped by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Really?
Well, I one of the things I really wanted to do with writing about water for people is restore a sense of wonder about water. We have completely lost track of how remarkable and important a substance it is. We never think about it. And so I had this odd moment. I was 4 or 5 months into reporting the book, working on the book full time. Talking to a physician actually on the phone about what happens when you get dehydrated, and I realized that I had no idea where water came from. I didn't know where Lake Michigan came from. I didn't know where the Pacific Ocean came from. I didn't know where Niagara Falls came from. Obviously, I've seen the same diagram we've all seen a million times with the rain and the runoff and the ocean and the evaporation and all that. But where did the water come in the first place? And I actually hurried off the phone with this nephrologist, and I ended up talking for 2 weeks to astronomers, to cosmologists. It turns out that all the water on Earth was created out in space. There is no mechanism creating and destroying water on Earth. All the water that's here was all the water that was delivered here when the planet was formed. It was formed out in these huge gas clouds out in space, hydrogens and oxygens slamming against each other and forming water. There's a big debate about how the water actually got here. Did it get here in the rocks that formed the planet? Did it get here from comets and asteroids? I'm definitely not competent to judge what the correct answer there is. But it was all formed in space and delivered here, and it's the only thing we ever encounter in our whole lives that looks exactly like it looked when it was delivered to the planet. You know, all the rocks, the granite countertops, our iPhones, our blue jeans, everything came from space at some level, of course, but none of it came here looking like what it looks like now. And so the water on Earth is a closed loop. Water does get taken apart and put back together, but it's all the same water. And so that, to me, was really amazing. It's cosmic juice at some level. And so yes, it is quite possible that the water in your Evian bottle was slurped by a dinosaur 200 million years ago, and of course peed by the dinosaur. And I guess the point of saying that to people is two things. First of all, notion that reusing water from cities, taking our wastewater and cleaning it and reusing it, is somehow unappealing is absurd. That's all we do. The water you drink, there's no such thing as fresh water. It's all been here for 4 billion years. And also, we've got more than enough water. But there's no way of making new water. We're not growing any new water. And so while we have more than enough, and while we can always clean the water, there's great virtue in understanding that we have to take care of the water we've got, because there's no machine we can plug in. There's no wilderness we can preserve where new tens of millions of gallons of water are being made.
Yeah. Greg in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen. I just thought it was, I think it's important to point out that the price we pay the municipality to produce our water is not directly substitutable with the price we pay at the stores for our water, because just here in Madison, I have a master's in water resources. Here in Madison, there's manganese contamination. They chlorinate water. There are old houses that have lead solder, and when they take water up, that lead bleeds back into the water system. There was a proposal to require people to clean it up, but that failed because it was too costly. And then in my own particular housing complex, it's a large place, and they soften the water. So that's like four reasons I can't drink from my tap. So, you know, I think the willingness to pay. I know that the municipalities have been upset about the plastic bottles, and they often claim that a lot of the bottled water is no different from tap water. But that's regulated. Drinking water, artesian water, spring water, purified water, those are four different categories, and only the drinking water comes from a tap. The other three have to meet stringent criteria, and they really are better than your tap water.
Where does your water come from in Madison?
We have a well, and there are issues with recharge. We take a lot of water out of the ground. It's out of, you know, there's like 19 municipal wells here. They're very deep. It's good aquifer. It's good quality water. But again, there is some manganese contamination. They chlorinate it. My particular landlord softens the water. And what was the other one? The lead contamination.
Right.
So once the water comes up out of the ground, it's in the pipes of the city. People who have lead solder in their plumbing actually contaminate that water with lead. So I used to filter the water. Get rid of the chlorine and the lead.
Uh-huh.
But the manganese isn't going to get filtered out by that. So I just buy I buy spring water.
Charles.
Well, I think one thing you said I don't quite agree with. I obviously don't know the details of Madison, and if you're only comfortable drinking bottled water, that's fine. You know, you should make your own choice. Tap water is intensively regulated. It is regulated in a way that bottled water is not. Tap water in a system the size of the Madison Water Utility is sampled once an hour. Bottled water companies are only required to test their water. Big bottled water companies are only required to test their water once a week. And they aren't required to report the results of those tests to anybody. They are simply required to put them in a file in their own offices. If the regulators come by, the documents have to be in the file. Even if bottled water companies find violations, they aren't required to report the violations to anybody. So, now, you've raised a whole bunch of things. Unfortunately, tap water is typically tested as it's going out the door of the treatment plant. I don't know about the manganese contamination. Many of the things that you ticked, the other three things you ticked off, a typical water filter will take care of. And the resources necessary to provide bottled water, even just drinking water and cooking water for a home, are, you know, that's a lot, asking a lot. And the municipal water system is important, of course, not just for drinking water, but for things like manufacturing, businesses, restaurants, and not to mention fire protection. So obviously everybody gets to make their own choices, but I think. To me, the danger from bottled water is two things. This myth that tap water is dangerous, and the second thing is bottled water undermines support for municipal water, and we all rely on municipal water. Even Greg, who doesn't want to drink it, depends on it in many, many, many ways every day, and the reliability of it. And so I think we need to be careful not to smear the tap water system because we don't like the chlorine taste.
Thank you, Greg, very much. Unless you want a quick response before we move on. He's gone. Thank you, Greg, very much for your call. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with Charles Fishman, who is the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in. We have many of them, actually, from Margaret in La Crosse. The Wisconsin Association of Local Health Department and Boards would like to support National Groundwater Week, March 11th through the 18th. What would you, Charles, like to see local health departments do to create awareness of our precious water resource?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that health departments can make sure that the school systems in the communities where the health department operates have a good water education curriculum. You know, one of the best ways to change attitudes and change awareness is to start in elementary and secondary school, just so people understand, you know, some real basics. Where does our water come from? What's required to get it to us? What happens to it when it goes back down the drain? And I think, and you know, without being geeky, but in an appealing way, what's the value of clean, safe water that we never think about? And what happens when clean, safe water isn't available or goes away? What's the damage? And so, without putting fresh burdens on the local health departments that already have a lot on their plate, just the ability to make sure that local school systems, their science and social studies curriculums, have a good understanding of the local water system and how it operates, and can teach that to, you know, fifth graders and seventh graders in an interesting way would go a long way toward doing that.
Ron in Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Great show. Thanks for having it.
Sure.
The reason I'm calling is just to find out what the guest thinks about legislatively mandated additives that are put in municipality water, things like fluoride, for instance, which has had some controversy surrounding it, and some municipalities are having it removed. What does the guest think about additives like that? I mean, I've even heard things such as medical community advocates wanting statins put into water. So I guess I'm just curious what the guest thinks about things like this.
Well, as a guy who takes Lipitor every day, I do not want statins put into the drinking water supply. And everybody who takes cholesterol-lowering drugs is putting statins into the water supply, because we all pee, and a little bit of the statins comes out every time we go to the bathroom. So I don't want pharmaceuticals in the drinking water supply. And if you go all the way back to the point Greg made about chlorine, you know, chlorine does have some byproducts, and chlorine in water systems has to be, it turns out, managed carefully to make sure that those byproducts don't have a long-term health effect on people. There are actually new ways of disinfecting water. It's important to remember, why was chlorine put in water in the first place? It completely changed the country. It changed the lifespan of Americans to disinfect water. The fact that there's now new technology, it's expensive. You can use UV light and you can use ozone to disinfect water. Means that we don't have to rely on chlorine if there's communities where that, you know, ends up being an objection. Fluoride is something that I confess I've only sort of dipped my toe in. I'm a child of the fluoride era. I grew up drinking fluoridated water, and so I have a little bit of a bias in favor of it. It really helped the world I lived in not have tooth decay. I don't think the research is really clear on whether taking fluoride out turns out to damage children's teeth. And so I all I would say is I think you need to be really careful what you put in water, but the reason fluoride's in there is the same reason niacin is in bread. There's not another good way of tackling what was a huge public health problem, or there wasn't a good way of tackling it at the time that was done. I think it's absolutely worth saying, are there better ways of protecting children's teeth? Do we have better ways of cleaning those teeth and making sure that, that tooth enamel doesn't decay than putting something in the water that, that goes to everybody? But those choices weren't made in a malicious way at all, and they have had a dramatic effect on public health over time. That doesn't mean that we always need to do what's always been done. It's okay to ask the question, is that the right path going forward?
Here's an important but rather long email from Bill in Appleton, who just returned from a week in Baudin, I don't know how you pronounce it, Baudin, Haiti, a mountain village about 4 hours south of Port-au-Prince. To supply water for making lunch for 200 students in the parish high school, one woman walked back and forth from the water source to the kitchen. She carried a 5-gallon bucket on her head with a gallon on top of that. She also carried a 5-gallon bucket in each hand. Doing the math, she carries roughly 125 pounds of water each trip. She starts about 7 in the morning and is finished about 11 a.m., each trip taking roughly an hour. And, of course, every gallon of water must be boiled to be safe to cook or clean dishes. So a tremendous amount of scarce wood is used to purify the water. And deforestation causes local weather patterns, resulting in less rainfall in the areas that need it the most. My question is, what are the fresh water supply alternatives using desalination techniques? Is this economically feasible, and does it use a great deal of electricity, gasoline, or diesel? Thank you.
Well, that email points up exactly the problem. That woman, let's just pause a moment and appreciate that that woman 4 or 5 days a week exerts enormous energy and effort and determination just to get water. What if we could liberate her from that and let her apply that energy to planning today's reading or math or political science curriculum for those students instead of just carrying water? Obviously, that's absurd. I'm not sure that desal is the right solution there, though. The email writer goes immediately to a high-tech solution. If those kinds of solutions worked in a place like Haiti, they'd be in place. The problem is even the middle-tech solution, for some reason, isn't available. A pump with electricity and a basic sand filter and some kind of a chlorinator to disinfect the water so you don't have to boil it, right? So. Mm-hmm. Yes, desal works. It is incredibly energy intensive, and it's a high tech solution. Those kids need computers, but they may need a blackboard and chairs and pencils before they get computers. And if there's no electricity, the computers won't do them any good. And this is the same thing. These folks need there is water available. She walks to get it. They need a pump, a pipeline. You know, you can have a solar operated pump, a solar operated chlorinator, and a pipeline. Mm-hmm. And that would solve the problem.
Okay. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Great conversation here. I'm looking forward to finding out more about it with the book and where else all this water issue is going to show up. Because I remember more than 40 years ago, I used to have conversations with a really enlightened teacher I had in high school. And we used to talk about the future and the shortages of resources and things and the issues that were going to be happening. Now it turns out, and since those conversations, we've had gas shortages, sugar shortages, and now it's been continuous with the water shortages. And with the condition of the water being every time a water is used, isn't the cellular structure inhibited in some way with every time it's filtered or it's contaminated and has to be cleared again? Doesn't that change the original structure of the cellular water?
We have about 45 seconds, Charles.
No, you don't need to worry about that. Water can be cleaned over and over and over again. It does not damage or change or alter the water. And that, in fact, is one of the great things about water. You can reuse it infinitely as long as you have the energy and the technology to clean it.
All right. Charles, thank you very much for being with us. Have a good time in Milwaukee. You'll be here later.
Well, I am looking forward to my visit. And just so your listeners know, excerpts of the book are up at the book's website for free, thebigthirst.com. So if you're curious and want a little taste of the book, all you have to do is click. It's right there.
Great. Okay, thank you. Charles Fishman in Milwaukee later this week to talk about the economics of water. His book is The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. And he looks at the many ways that water resources will come to define this century. He spent a number of years studying the resource of water around the world. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, the recall, we'll hear from the state Democratic Party chair Mike Tate at 9, and we'll talk about Ulysses S. Grant. Ah, we get around, don't we? We get around. That'll be at 10 o'clock tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody. Navigate the snow carefully.